Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. This is News Talk.
You can email the show aliveandkicking at newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up, behind the scenes at Temple Street with head porter John Doyle, Daniela Moyles on her book Jump, and Sheila Shoiga on where wellness sits in her life. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? I did touch on it a little bit last week, but I have been struggling a bit with this phase one thing, what's okay and what's not okay. Obviously, I still know what the guidelines are, but as things open up more and more, I find it a bit stressful. I think it obviously comes back to the fact that my personal situation is that I'm going into my cocooning parents' home to give them some help, as with my dad, it's considered a medical necessity. And obviously, I still keep my distance. I'm wearing a mask and gloves, but it does feel like an intrusion on family life at a time where I'd love to give my dad a smile or a hug, as I know you all would. And when I'm out with my family, very simple things in the park, and we'll run into another family we know and we talk at a distance, but kids being kids can get a little bit too close or touch the same ball or something, and then I'm thinking about it later and stressing about it. And my hubby went to meet some friends in the garden for the first time since all this happened, within 5k, no more than four people, and he got a taxi so we could have a couple of drinks, and he wore a mask and a glove, two gloves in fact, in the cab. And he said that that had a perspex wall blocking him for the driver, but it still fills me with dread. And I'm not trying to decimate the taxi industry further. I'm not suggesting that it's dangerous to get into one, but I'm just commenting on what previously were such simple behaviours, such as going to your parents for a cup of tea, meeting friends in the park, or getting a taxi, now have this worrying layer over them. And it's such an intrusion. I think in some ways I preferred where we were all on the same page. And I think naively I thought if we all stayed at home for a while that when we emerged it would be back to normal life. I didn't really think about living life with the virus still about. But look, we're making all the steps in the right direction. And, you know, recent discussions coming from the experts are about moving out of all of the phases. So look, we're all in it together, as we keep coming back to. And in things I saw and heard this week, I would recommend, if you haven't come across it already, Digging Deep, the documentary by Georgie Crawford. Georgie is a friend of mine and has been a guest on the show. And she has become well known for speaking openly about her breast cancer diagnosis. And she now has the very popular podcast, The Good Glow. And in the documentary, she is followed in the Swiss Alps running 12K, and it just is very inspirational. And she's joined by her husband, Jamie Crawford, who this week went public on her podcast saying that he had been diagnosed with MS 8 years ago. So to see both of them running to the top of a mountain in the snow is well worth a watch, I must say. And Angela Scanlon's podcast is another favourite of mine. It's called Thanks a Million and looks at what people are grateful for. And she speaks to Laura Dockrill. And Laura is an English poet and just a brilliant speaker, and she's just written a book about her experience with postnatal psychosis, which is something I had never heard of before. And Laura speaks so eloquently and so brilliantly about such a dark period in her life. And she also recommends a book. It's very interesting to me. It's Self-Help for Your Nerves by Dr. Claire Weeks. And there was a part of it, she says it's because the book described the science behind why things were happening for her, and that helped her get over it, that it wasn't just, as she describes, demons taking over her. There was a science behind it, and that really helped her in her recovery. But she also spoke about how Dr. Weeks talks about floating, and that when we get any kind of diagnosis for any illness, we often talk about fighting it and somebody's battle with cancer, for example, and that we should just float through any diagnosis. And it's just a different energy, and it's something that she found very positive. So I would definitely recommend a listen to that podcast and perhaps that book if that resonates with you. Daniela Moyles seemed to be winning at life. When you looked at her Instagram, a dream job as a radio host, raking it in as an influencer, drop dead gorgeous with a boyfriend to match, and photos of travels and fun. But behind it all, she was falling apart. Daniela quit everything and walked away to sort herself out. Well, correction, she jumped, and she's documented it all in her book, Jump, which is published by Gill and available now. And she is on the line. Hello, Daniela.
Hi, Claire. How are you?
I'm good. I devoured your book in 2 days. I was constantly dodging the kids and trying to get back to it. And throughout it all, I kept thinking what a brave undertaking it was, documenting your life, the good, the bad and the ugly. Why was it important for you to do this?
Oh, God, that's a tough question. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people will ask me that. Why? Why did you feel the need to do that? I think on the one, there was probably two things that came together in the book. I think on the one hand, I definitely always harbored the desire to write a book and never truly felt like I had anything to say or, you know, just to take up that space to kind of fill pages and then have somebody pay to read the story. I couldn't ever put together in my head what I would want to create despite the desire to do so. And then I suppose as I was traveling, it started to make a little bit more sense to me that this might be of interest to people and that the story might be relatable and even, I suppose, devourable.
Yeah, no, big time. You have a story to tell. And I mean, the fact that it starts, and that's sort of what I've given in the intro, and that's what's on the spine of or the back of the book, is that something that is picture perfect sometimes isn't. And sometimes I think it's a really bad indictment of society that we find it really hard to believe that someone who is good looking and successful is going to have any problems in their life. But that's just something that we seem to believe that, you know, if you can look good in a bikini, surely there's not a problem.
Yeah, that's probably a symptom of this kind of crazy social media era that we live in and how curated everything we see looks. And I know that we know beyond that, we know logically that that's not true, but it's very hard to kind of, it's hard to unsee what you see. And what you see is often not the whole picture. And it certainly wasn't with me. And I suppose I kind of felt like that was what made the book a worthy read, was the uncomfortable truths and also the peeling back of, you know, I think actually there's a bit of a movement around that now as well. There wasn't when I started the book, but in more recent kind of years, maybe there's been a little bit of a movement towards the imperfect perfect or kind of being a little bit more authentic. But when I kind of left and started on the journey, it was still very much in the, it was kind of ramping up into that influencer era. And it was, I think it was kind of the beginning of the really curated online life. And so I suppose, yeah, that kind of was exhausted for me. I wanted to do something a little bit more real. And the book would have been kind of forgettable, I think. It would have been a very privileged story of somebody kind of on their travels having a very privileged life without the context of what led me there. So it felt really important.
And you go right back, and something that I had to kind of put the book down and have a think about for a little while was when you went to a counsellor. Now, you sort of say at that time that you didn't really get anything out of the session bar this one line, and it was, if it's hysterical, it's historical. So if you are emotionally all over the place, chances are it's feeding back to a wound from earlier in your life, and it's worth going back and having a look at that. But that's actually very difficult to do. And you did it, and you talk about how you did it in the book. So it's not just you saying, oh, look, I wasn't happy and then I went traveling and here I am. I mean, there's really good steps that we can learn from as well. It is a self-help book of sorts.
I hope so, yeah, because it was definitely kind of a harrowing thing to go through personally, and then also to share it publicly. Is, you know, it's not a very Irish, we don't air our dirty laundry. We don't kind of sit in those uncomfortable things. You know, we kind of fortify the family and ourselves, and everything is fine. And obviously that's changing, but I don't know if it's changed to the extent that I've written in the book. I think it probably will be an uncomfortable read for some people, and it probably won't be something everybody understands. But for me, it feels like it's where we're going. I mean, I'm studying psychotherapy now, and the more that I learn, the more I understand the journey that I went on. I didn't at the time, but so many of our wounds, I suppose, or so many of our of the tools that we have to manage life are instilled in us before we even have the awareness to know that they are. And to change those things means really taking off the mask. And that's really difficult. Like, we can say we're taking off the mask. You can say, I know myself. You can say, I love myself. But to really do that work is very uncomfortable and very harrowing, actually. And that's a really heavy word. But to kind of sit in the parts of yourself that you don't like, or to take a really authentic look at the parts of yourself that are dysfunctional or failing or are not who you want to be, and to admit that they are you and that you'd like to change them is very different work. And I hope that I hope that comes across in the book. I hope that that's what makes it somewhat worthy of being published. And that it adds something to the conversation around mental health that I haven't yet heard. I've heard so much talk about the prevalence of anxiety, the prevalence of depression or mental health problems, but not a lot of conversation around kind of the uncomfortable things that underpin why they're so prevalent. And I think that that's because it's quite difficult to talk about those things. And I hope that this is a new step in that way. And it makes it a little bit more acceptable and relatable and commonplace.
And there were certainly markers from your past that you pinpointed that became chapters in the story, but that were pieces in the jigsaw of what made you you. And you went back and explored all of them. But still, essentially, you had a family that loved you and supported you. And I think sometimes we think, unless we were part of a really abusive situation, that we didn't have any traumas that are worth looking at. And we often have little wounds that need to be looked at and need to be acknowledged.
You know, that is so true. And that is such a thing I struggled with, was the permission to feel how I felt, because I didn't feel worthy of feeling that way. You know, what did I have to moan about? What did I have to complain about? But, you know, suffering is subjective. What is traumatic to you might be perfectly exciting to somebody else. It's about individual difference. There's things that happen to everybody that are traumatic that we don't even take the time to acknowledge. Not being heard can be traumatic to a child. I mean, you're going really down the opposite end of the spectrum here, where, you know, people can start to get into debates over this, but it comes down to individual difference. A life is worth examining, no matter what it appears like on paper or to other people, or what other people might think. What feels like something to you is worth examining, regardless of whether somebody else wants to validate or acknowledge how that feels to you.
Yeah. And I mean, look, that said, you had your mum's health struggles, your dad's health struggles, the shocking death of your very close cousin Kate. So, I mean, that's not to say it was nothing either. And you go through all of that in the book. But as I say, you reached a point in your life where you couldn't ignore what was coming up for you, and everything fell apart, and you chose to go solo traveling. Another thing I see as so, so brave. So at the start, you have an amazing picture of the globe. I even showed my 9-year-old son, and he was very impressed at the amount you have shaded in. You've covered a massive amount of the world. And look, the name of the book is Jump. And not only do you literally jump out of a plane and describe this in the book, but throughout it, you push yourself out of your comfort zone, test your fears, from either trekking up mountains alone in Peru to taking on a very intense yoga teacher training course in Thailand. And you, as you say, you did it to feel alive, to feel there was colour in your life and not just grey. So what about now? What about now that you're home? How are you dealing with just the day-to-day here back in Ireland?
The transition was definitely difficult when I came home, because I ended up travelling for about 2.5 years. I only initially went for the year, but I found so much of myself, so cliche, out in the world, and I obviously have that in the pages of the book. But I did eventually know that it had an expiry date. You know, I could only drain my savings for so long, and I did get to a point where I had to think about my future. Coming home was difficult because I suppose you've gotten so used to just constant stimulation, constant novelty, constant movement, and then you have to kind of retract your world a little bit. But in saying that, I don't think I've ever had, you know, my own growth tested quite as much as coming home and then there being a pandemic and then there being everything else. And it's testament to what I think I did actually manage to overcome out on the road, because I every day feel very fulfilled and grateful, and I treasure my peace of mind now. My days are probably unconventional, but they work for me. You know, I feel like I've taken back autonomy of my own time, my own being, and I live differently now for sure, but I'm very, very happy, and I don't know if I would have thought I could say that at another time.
Well, I just think you're very brave and brilliant, and you'll have to come back on again and we'll talk about where wellness sits in your life.
You
have
that.
The Still, an incredible resource for people as well. But for now, it was all about the book, and I've made it sound like it's a heavy read. It is in places, but it's also funny. It's a major scoop into the Dublin scene of influencers and rocking up for photo shoots in your bikini, and I loved it. So I highly recommend it. It's called Jump, and it's published by Gill, and it's written by Daniela Moyles. It's available now. Daniela, thank you very, very much.
Claire, thank you so much for having me. That was lovely.
Coming up, behind the scenes at Temple Street Children's Hospital with Head of Portering Services, John Doyle.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
As a parent or a guardian, you never want to bring your child to hospital. But if you've ever been to Temple Street Children's Hospital for whatever fall, bump or something more serious, you'll know that there's something very special about the place. No matter what the issue, they make you and your child feel safe, feel important, and the care is second to none. And it's not one person there who makes this happen, but an incredible team of people passionate about their job. And you always feel that children's well-being is the main focus of everything that they do. And one of the people in that team is head porter John Doyle. Many of you will be familiar with him if you're familiar with Temple Street. He's very much a part of the fabric of the place, and some might say the furniture, because he's been working there for over 40 years. He is on the line now. Hello, John.
Hello, Claire. How are you?
Good. Very good. I'm delighted to have you on, because there's not many people nowadays who can say they've worked in the same place for 40 years.
That's true enough.
And when you started out in Temple Street, did you ever think that you would be still there over 40 years later?
No. I came in August of 79 with the full intention of being gone by the end of 1980. Well, for some apparent reason, 40 years on, I'm still very much part and parcel of Temple Street.
And tell me about starting then. Did you go in doing the same job?
No, I initially arrived here as a 21-year-old with a family history. So I started off as a general porter. And from 79 all the way up to about 1990, I just looked upon it as a general job. It's a job, and I just had to come in, turn up, do what I had to do. And that was it. But I presume from around mid-90s, when I started to develop, I'd like to call it this hunger for Temple Street, and fully begin to understand what healthcare was about. I became head porter in 1995, and from then I've managed a team of 27 porters providing a 24-hour-a-day service to all areas throughout the hospital.
And what is it then that you had your eyes open to, that you say there, where you really got to know what it was all about?
There was probably several reasons where at some stage the patients started to get, I started to become more in contact with the patients. And when I started to learn of their stories and their journeys, it sort of flicked the light switch on me that this was more about the people who were here in them days for the same time as I'm here now, about why they come in every day to work, why they enjoyed coming in to work, what gave them job satisfaction. And at the end of the day, it was really all about what would I do or what I should be doing for the patient.
I said it's a very special place, and it is. What do you think are the ingredients that make it that way?
There is a multitude of ingredients. I suppose Temple Street is a family. We have the patient at the centre of everything we do, And therefore, there's a heartbeat that goes on that it's very hard not to hear it. There's a mixture of youth, experience, all range of emotions. And it just really is a place where when you look upon healthcare, it's probably one of them areas where you never thought that the difference you make is equally as significant as the next person.
In a way, you can often be the, once they've checked in at reception, you can often be their first port of call. And it's a very difficult time. I mean, it's one thing to have somebody fall off the trampoline and come in, but sometimes you meet parents in their darkest hour. How do you handle that?
I suppose, as a human being, we all go through dark periods in our life. But in healthcare, a lot of people tend to use the words care and cure. But ultimately, in healthcare, it's so diverse and so complex that there's not the end result that everybody hopes for. I think how I go personally cope through it is I rely on the support as much of my colleagues and friends as anybody else. But I think if we do our best through all scenarios, then we can't be said at the end of the day that we did not try. So respect becomes very much paramount to what happens in the dark days. But as I found with my parents here, it's often the kind word that just asks, how are you today? How is Billy today? Can I get you anything? And that generally will lift a lot of people away from the clinical end and the grey areas.
Yeah, which is why it's such an important part alongside all the new information they have to take from the doctor, the nurse, the surgeon, or whatever it is. That those words, are you okay? How are you? Can I get you anything? Are just as important and a bit of light relief, aren't they?
They are indeed. And I suppose what we try to do here is we walk in the footsteps of the patient. Then we will fully understand more about what we should be doing and what we have to do. And the main thing here about Tempsley is it's the friendly, recognisable face is as key to anything as anybody else. So from the porter to the cleaner, to the doctor, to the nurse, to the receptionist, that's what we should be displaying at all times.
Well, you feel it. I was there recently enough with a fairly slight incident with my little girl. So, you know, I was lucky. I was in and out. But you certainly have that work, and I felt it from all areas. And I've also seen you in action, John, when I've been there with Ireland AM for the Halloween appeal, the Christmas appeal. And there are families who go long term to Temple Street, either as an outpatient or spend months in the hospital. And you become a part of their journey, and you're on first name terms with the patients, with the kids themselves. You're high-fiving, you know, you're their friend. You really involve yourself in their journey.
Well, my belief is that when I arrive for work in the morning to the time I go home at night time, I come very much part of the Tempestry fabric. My life has certainly been much better place by giving as much back as I get that these patients and parents give us on a constant basis. And you are right, when people have to spend 8 or 9 months away from home in Mayo, Donegal, and are based in a building that to them is just a second home, we make Temple Street become their permanent home for the duration of their here. I am not the only one who does this. Believe you me, there is incredible people around everywhere who seem to go beyond the call of duty and the extra mile on a very much daily basis. And I think that has been the great thing for parents and patients. What they see is that how willing we are here to become an extended part of their family.
And it's a real Irish thing, isn't it? We keep the sense of humour going. We have the bit of crack, you know, no matter what's going on. We do try to have that. And you're key with that. You have that going on.
Well, sometimes we might be described as loud and eccentric, but I think at the end of the day, people fully see us as having a heart and that we show the same emotions as they do. So it is very much a tangible approach and a very much joined up approach to how it works.
And there are big changes ahead with the move for the hospital. So what do you think that'll mean for Temple Street?
Well, I suppose I've been rather fortunate. From about the start of the millennium, there's been massive changes in Temple Street itself. So we have, well, the structure of the hospital remained the same, but there's been a massive revamp, increase of services. And this really all started to come about through a massive, hugely successful foundation team who would go off and raise the required capital through a lot of many different ventures, solely to be able to bring Tempestry into the modern era. This would involve them work with the projects team, the stakeholders, but more importantly, it started to evolve around what the patient wanted, what the parent wanted, and to start to listen to their needs. So I think if you visit us prior to the millennium and after the millennium, you will think that Tempestry has reinvented itself over a very short period. Also, as you know, we were initially on the move to the mother campus. A lot of our work that was done was prefabricated work on the belief that we would not be here. What's now the dream, now the reality has become fact that we are on the move to the new Children's Hospital of Ireland, which is something that has been long overdue, and it is hugely enthusiastic workforce can't wait to get in through its front doors.
Well, good stuff. And what about you then? What does the future hold for you, John? You were due to retire at 40 years and yet here you are at 41. What's your plan? Will you stay on until the new building?
Well, the immortal question most of my team ask me, and I have to say my team are one of the most honest and hardworking teams that you could ever wish to work with. So I suppose at times I would say to them, that's it, thrown in the towel, I'm finished. Look, COVID-19 is only one thing that has changed the dynamics of healthcare. I would hope, with good health and a lot of perseverance from a lot of other people, that I would see the new Children's Hospital. I think the experience and legacy of the people who've gone before us, I think the expectation levels that are expected to come from us, I think the merger of the three paediatric hospitals to work with highly skilled and motivated fellow colleagues across the whole healthcare network. If I was to make a commitment today, I will tell you that I will be there in the new Children's Hospital.
Well, look, I know you'd do anything for the place. You can see it. And your team are incredible, not just your portering team, but also everyone around you at Temple Street. And if you want to help support Temple Street and find out more, you can go to templestreet.ie. Head of Portering Services, John Doyle, thank you so much for all that you do and for talking to me today.
Thanks very much, Claire.
Coming up after the break, Sheila Shoiga on Being Real.
Alive and kicking with Claire McKenna. This is News Talk.
So Sheila Shoiga is one of Ireland's most well-known faces, and what a face, rising to prominence as a TV and radio presenter. Herself and her sister Gráinne presented the afternoon talk show Shoiga for many years. In more recent times, Sheila has moved into the area of wellness following a brush with thyroid cancer in 2012. She trained as a yoga instructor. She also has the most mesmerising voice for meditation, which is something she has turned to in her life, and she has spoken openly about struggles such as miscarriage. She launched her podcast, Ready to Be Real, last year, and it has featured incredible conversations with people such as Vicky Phelan, Richie Sadlier and Tommy Tiernan. So I'm delighted that for the launch of her website, readytobereal.com, Sheila has agreed to a conversation with me. Well, Sheila, you're very welcome.
Oh, Claire, thank you. What a gorgeous intro. And it just says everything about you. And you know I'm mad about you anyway. So I'm so glad that we're actually having this chat, even though I'd much prefer if we were face to face having it. But at least we can have it.
I know. And we do have conversations of sorts regularly on voice notes to each other's Instagram and WhatsApp. So this is a step on. We go through phases until we can sit face to face again. Now, in my intro, I say a brush with thyroid cancer, but it was more than that. It must have been a very tough time, but was a very pivotal moment in your life.
Yeah, but you know what? You're right, I think, Claire. I mean, like everything, I think when we move on, sometimes we can forget stuff that we've gone through. And it's the same for everyone, because whether you've had a cancer diagnosis or something else, it doesn't have to be a physical illness. It can be, you know, a relationship issue, you know, work issues, whatever it is, anything that causes anyone pain or discomfort of any type that makes them kind of re-examine their life. I think when you come through it, you can tend to kind of forget, because I think we're wired as humans to heal, to move on, to progress. And you know, we can't stay stuck in that time. But yeah, of course, when I go back into it, and for me, it was 2011. I was 32. I'm 41 now. It was a scary and strange time in my life. And it was because a lot kind of came at me at once. Now, in saying that, I was very fortunate. I didn't have to have chemotherapy. My treatment was relatively straightforward. I had two operations to remove my thyroid gland. I had treatment and it was successful. So within a year, pretty much it was September, the first operation, and by the following August, my treatment had been complete. And then you're kind of, it's the waiting game, you know, will it come back? Will you be okay? And you're going back in for your tests and your, all of that kind of stuff. But for me now, yes, you were so right. It was a pivotal point in my life. It was something that now I wouldn't want to change for a moment, because I know it's led me to where I am now. And where I'm at now is a good place. You know, look, we all still have stuff thrown at us from time to time, and it's not always easy. And that's life. You know, that's life for every single person. But I feel, because I went through that, I feel a bit more able to handle the stuff that life throws at me now, because I did a lot of work on myself because I had to. You know, from that, I realized that I got into quite a dark place. I was feeling quite down about my point in my life. And I was, you know, I suppose I was being the victim, as can happen to a lot of us. You know, why me? Why did this happen to me? This is awful. Da, da, da. You know, because I went through a breakup towards the end of my cancer treatment that did come out of the blue at the time. Now that I look at it, I kind of should have known, because, you know, I think when you're going through something, you're focused on something else. So my attention was on getting better and getting through the cancer diagnosis and my treatment. So I wasn't really looking at everything else. But look, it is what it is. And I'm very thankful for it now, because I suppose the universe was trying to communicate to me that this isn't really where you're meant to be. No offense to the other person, but this isn't really where you're meant to be going in life.
And
so anyway,
had wellness been a part of your life before that?
Yeah, it had. It absolutely had. I suppose I have been looking at this thing called life and what it's all about from different perspectives since I was a teenager, if that makes sense to you. As in, I've been questioning things. I have been looking at what I have been, what I grew up in, what we're conditioned to think as fact, as normal, as reality. I've been kind of exploring that for years. And in terms of going off on retreats and doing things, I would always been very, very interested in it. But I didn't get into yoga in the way I got into it in a big way till I got sick with cancer. So towards the end of that, I found a yoga therapist. I found a yoga class that really, I felt just, something resonated for me in a big way. And I got a lot from it. And it was healing, and it was hard work because you have to do a lot of self-reflection. But I'd only really dabbled in yoga. And I didn't think it was for me, because I didn't think that I had the, in inverted commas, yoga body, that I wasn't, you know, this, I didn't fit the bill physically or what I thought it was. And now I realize that has nothing to do with what yoga is about. And I went on to study, and I've done a number of courses in yoga. And within the framework of what yoga is, I really connect with the mantra side of things, the meditation, the sound therapy side of things. So I'm big into that stuff. And that for me is my way to connect with whatever it is that we call it, that voice inside, your higher being, whatever it is that connects for people. But that is my way in. And I learned that through the yoga practice. And I suppose a big part of that was the fact that I nearly lost my voice with having thyroid cancer. So my tumor was sitting on my vocal cords, and it was a very serious risk that I would lose my voice. So I think there was a big message in this for me. It was kind of like, okay, are you prepared to really, to be yourself, to be real in your life, to speak your truth, you know, and to use your voice, to properly use your voice.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big push if you're faced with possibly losing your voice, and then you manage to dodge that you're only going to use your voice in an authentic way. And is that what Ready to Be Real, the name of your podcast and now your website and the whole kind of wellness movement you're getting going, is that what that's all about?
Yeah, exactly. I think because I kind of had to do the work myself to discover, you know, who I was, what I'm about, what am I doing, what is my offering, you know, because we're all offering something to the world in one way or another, regardless of what we do for a living. Or in some cases, you know, whether you don't do anything for a living and your job is to be a stay-at-home parent or whatever it is, but we all have a purpose, we all have a reason for being here. And I think I'm only starting to really peel that back and discover it. And that's why, you know, yeah, that's why I set up the website. That's why I'm having the kind of conversations that I'm having, because I know that there's an appetite amongst everyone to be more real, to be, this is who I am, this is what I'm about. And that's why it's exciting. So yeah, I'm using my voice now for recording meditations. It's something I do when I give wellness talks. So they're available on the website and along with the podcast and all the rest. And yeah, it just feels like a very comfortable space for me to be in. It feels like, you know, I'm finally doing what I was always meant to be doing, and let's see where it goes from there. And I think the truth is we're all on our own paths, and nobody gets out of this life without something being thrown at them.
You have spoken about miscarriage quite openly, which I think is very important to do. But it's also a very difficult thing to open the doors when there's going to be an article in a newspaper about it and there's going to be discussion online about it. So is that something that you just felt really motivated to do to help other people, or was it helping you also?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it was actually quite selfish. It was helping myself and helping us as a couple, because we realized that when we started talking to friends about it, how many of our friends, probably particularly more Damien than me, that opened up to him and said, oh yeah, we've experienced it too. And he didn't know. And he said, like, nobody talks about this. So we had the discussion ourselves. Is this something that we're okay with talking about? Like, are you okay with me talking about this? And he said, absolutely, I fully support you. So I knew that for me, it was going to help me come to terms with it, actually not feel like, you know, I can't be honest. And I suppose what I've just said there and what I'm about, I'm trying to be as much me as I can in my life, and also now on the likes of Instagram or Twitter, because you can, and they're not the full picture. They're only a glimpse into a person's life. They're only an aspect of it. But I did want to, even if that is only a glimpse, I wanted that glimpse to be authentic. So thankfully, as a result of talking about it publicly, I seemed to help others not feel as alone. And I suppose the more people of, in inverted commas, profile who do speak about it, it's also a good thing. And my recent conversation on my podcast is with my friend Catherine Thomas. And Catherine spoke about having had miscarriages before, long before I did. And we've been friends for many, many years. And we spoke about it during our conversation as well, which, again, I've been getting a lot of feedback about. Because, you know, it's something that affects so many people. And I think sometimes when you're going through it, you don't realize how many. And the more we have honest conversations about it that are honoring the process and how difficult it is. And I suppose that the mark that it leaves in your heart and in your soul, and it never goes away. And I think we need to acknowledge that. And I realize I still will be probably coming to terms with it for a long time or forever. And that's just the way it is. That doesn't mean I'm not content in my day-to-day life. I'm extremely grateful. I'm very happy. But I do realize that it's a powerful type of grief, and we need to honor it and not brush it under the carpet or pretend it didn't happen. And everybody has their process. Not everybody's going to be comfortable talking about it. Not everybody's going to be comfortable going on Insta stories and talking about it. And I get that. I completely get that. But if it encourages one other person to maybe open up to someone else in their circle, you know, that they haven't already spoken to, that it might help them, because talking does help. It does help us, you know. And you know, I'm really glad that I did that. And I will always try and be as open as I can, because life isn't easy for any of us, you know. And yet I feel like I'm the luckiest woman in the world. I know I have so much to be thankful for. You know, don't get me wrong, I'm extremely grateful for my life. And I'm a big believer in everything happens for a reason. If we're destined to have another kid, we will. And if we're not, we're not. And right now I'm not in a place where I'm just kind of minding myself, minding ourselves. It's not something that we're thinking of right now, because I've realized that actually psychologically I'm not in that space right now. And I think for me, I need to have, you know, what I spoke about before is that sense of alignment between not just being right, feeling well physically, but also feeling capable and able in my thoughts and in my heart as well. And right now I'm just not there yet.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder about the 12-week thing and not saying anything until 12 weeks and you get the all clear. And I mean, it's up to anybody. If they don't tell until 6 months, or they tell on the first day they find out, it's up to everybody else. But we've kind of set this marker and that silence that we create from when you find out you're expecting to 12 weeks. it creates a kind of a vacuum to allow the whole thing to be silent. Because you never said you were pregnant, you don't feel you can just come out and say, by the way, I had a miscarriage. And I think maybe if we were more open more early on, just it's a very difficult thing to talk about. I had one myself. It's not something you just don't, you want to just try and get on with your life in some ways without everybody wanting to sit down and, you know, feel sorry for you all the time, much as there's people in your life that you do share with. But I sometimes wonder if we were more open from when we find out we were pregnant, and if it doesn't happen and you don't get past the 3 months and you talk about that too, that it might just become a little bit more normal. And what about the men in the situation, certainly with your own partner, Damien? Do you think men are talking about it? I mean, you'll always have a best female friend that you can turn to, or a sister or a mom. But do you think the men are talking about it a bit more now?
Well, from his experience, he found that when he did talk to friends about it, that's when they shared with him. But it wasn't something that necessarily came up before then. But he's an open kind of person anyway, and he does believe in talking. Like, and as you said there, to be honest, a few things you said there really brought to mind. When we were pregnant with Cathal, like, we told families well before the 12 weeks, but that's just the way we're wired, I suppose. We kind of decided for us we didn't wait, and I appreciate why. And what I was told by a consultant was the 12 weeks was there really before early scans were brought in, because we didn't know whether the pregnancy was successful until you kind of got to a certain point and you could have that first scan, or it was obvious that the woman was pregnant. Whereas now, thankfully, you know, you can book in for your early scan. You can find, and usually it's not always the case, because unfortunately I had two miscarriages, and I had a situation on the second pregnancy where I went in for the first scan and everything was great, and I could see the heartbeat and everything was brilliant. We went back in for the second scan, and there was no heartbeat, and it was devastating. So, you know, I've said one thing and now I'm contradicting myself. But I suppose what you've said as well is something else that I think is really important to remember. When you spoke about maybe not wanting to talk about it because of getting sympathy, I think it's something that we all need to be aware of, that sympathizing with someone and feeling pity for someone is actually very damaging. It's really destructive. And it's something I've experienced at a few points in my life. I really felt it actually when I came back to work after having cancer. And I was in work and nobody knew I'd had cancer, but then of course I spoke about it publicly, and it was like I got this avalanche of pity. And people mean well, their heart is in the right place, but it's actually very destructive. You're better off, if somebody has shared something big with you or they're upset, to sit with them and allow them dictate the conversation. Have compassion, open your mind to it. And actually, sometimes silence is the most compassionate thing you can do for someone, and just be there and listen to them rather than filling the air with, oh, isn't it devastating? Sure, it's awful. And sure, I'll tell you about my friend now. She had 5 miscarriages and God love her. That doesn't help anyone. And same if you've gone through a cancer diagnosis or anything big. When you start to say, I'm so sorry, can't, you know, people mean well, and I know they do. And please, I hope I'm not coming across as a tough cookie, but I do think it's an important message for us to all be aware of that. And I put my foot in it too, don't get me wrong. I absolutely do. Because sometimes we don't know what to say, and all we want to do is give that person a hug. But sometimes the best thing you can do for that person is just say, how are you doing? How are you really doing? How are you getting on? And listen to the answer. Actually listen to the answer and not try and tell them how they're feeling.
Yeah, and don't follow on. No, and it's up to all of us. You're right. And, you know, it's coming from the right place that you're saying it. I just think sometimes if we just listened instead of feeling we have to come back in, and I do it myself with our story, our example, and try and fill the silence, it's okay. All you can do is just listen and say, well, look, I'm here if you need me. And that's kind of it. You want a cup of tea and then leave it at that.
Absolutely.
And I must say, you are an excellent communicator, obviously, but you are a very good listener. On your podcast, you're not afraid to ask the big questions. There are questions I've heard, as somebody who works doing the same type of job, that you've asked of people that I thought, oh, I might have been scared to ask that question. And you ask it with compassion and with love, and you listen to the answer. And I think that's an amazing, amazing skill to have. You're not afraid to let the person speak either and have their say. So I would recommend, if you haven't delved into the podcast, I know it's a popular one, get in there. There are some great conversations to be heard. You'll find it all at readytoberial.com. Sheila Shoiga, thank you very, very much.
Oh, Claire, thank you. Thank you so much.
So that's it from Alive and Kicking for this week. Thank you very much for listening. For all your comments that come in during the week, I do read all your emails and they mean a lot. Thank you to my producer, John Fardy, and Jojo Cordoza, who was on sound. I'll see you next week.